Hi, everybody. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and this is Holding Court. All right, very excited about this edition of Holding Court, everyone. I got the number one ranked American male tennis player, Mr. Riley Opelka, joining me from the desert in California, where he's getting set to play in the BNP Paribas Open. Riley, I appreciate you joining me. I'm coming to you from cold and actually snowed here in New York yesterday. So tell me, get me jealous about the weather out there in the desert right now.
Oh, man, it's brutal. Yeah, it's probably 65 degrees right now, sunny as always, and it's tennis paradise for a reason. It's really beautiful, and you can't beat the scenery here, the mountains, the weather. It's tough to find another place like it.
So how does that sound, the number one ranked American?
Yeah, I don't really get caught up in that. I really don't. I think it'd mean more if it was like the number one, ranked Russian or Serbian I don't get caught up in it. Things change every week and I don't, kind of seeing how people have handled that in the past. Maybe back in the day when Agassi and Sampras and, Johnny Mack, those guys were playing, it was probably a huge honor because they were fighting it forward amongst each other, but I think it's a little different. I don't get so caught up in it.
You've been pretty outspoken about some in the press and others giving you and other Americans a hard time. Where's the next great American player? Obviously, I was part of that conversation often when I was running player development at the USTA. And of course I was a Davis Cup captain for 10 years, but you're part of, a group of really good young players coming up. And I think you guys, you correct me if I'm wrong, have pushed each other, yourself, Tommy Paul, obviously Francis Tiafoe, Taylor Fritz. I mean, you're all right around the same age. So do you think that this process of you guys coming up with the juniors and obviously on the pros has helped each of you individually and collectively?
Totally. I think from the professional standpoint, post-junior days, the best thing we've done for each other is just having a friend on the road, especially when we're starting off. You don't know the older guys. I didn't kind of go grab dinner with Isner and Stevie J and Query at that time when I was 18. So the fact that I had Francis, Tommy, and Taylor to go hang out with every week and grab dinner was huge. And I realized, it's all I know. I'm fortunate to be a part of that. But, you talk to, guys like Jack Sock or, Donald Young from the earlier generation, they didn't really have, too many other guys to hang out with. Jack, let's say, would be playing the hardcore tournament in the States, and maybe Don wanted to go play on clay or vice versa, and they'd be alone. So having them just around, just to hang out with while we're, in a foreign country or in another part of the world, just gives us a sense of being at home, which is quite nice. And I think one of the most important roles in our development of having each other was, like you said, in the junior age, from age 12 to 18, because those are the guys we train with every day and push each other every day.
It's pretty amazing, actually, because I've gone back a couple of times and looked at the draws, like at Kalamazoo, the big junior tournament for the boys, and, see like 5-6 of you guys that are now like legit top 100 and for many of you higher pros. I mean, that just doesn't happen. I mean, that used to happen maybe in the old days before there were so many players coming from the rest of the world and where the Europeans started to come out of the woodworks and all the different European countries. But pretty amazing, how much depth there was in your guys' age group.
Totally. Yeah, it's unheard of. I think, I listened to your podcast with Jose and I thought it was spot on so many things. And like you said, how you were hearing about it in the press as you were head of U.S. tennis back in the day, your program was spot on. It was a long-term program. And I've told you this myself, I don't think you've gotten near the credit you deserve for it, because you invested in the juniors. You invested in the 12, 13, 14-year-olds at the time, which was me, Tommy, Francis, Taylor, Michael Moe, you know, a lot of us. And that's where you and made your investment. And unfortunately, you know, you caught some fire for it based on the current men's U.S. Open results at that year, when everything that you were investing in was the long-term play. And it really showed that it's really worked well. It is a long-term investment. And I think you and Jose touched up on it a bit. And I really like the part where you guys are talking about you can't develop a Grand Slam champion. You can't train a Grand Slam champion. That's within the player. I mean, you guys have a big say in getting us into the top 50 or the top 100. And then from that point on, it's on us. And I totally agree with that. I think that couldn't have been more spot on.
Well, speaking of being on us, because, you know, I'm good friends with your longtime coach, Jay Berger, who I worked with at the USTA for many, many years. And he's just one of the class acts in tennis. And so he keeps me updated over, you know, the course of the last few years. I always text him when I'm watching you play at a big tournament, if you're doing well or not doing well. I'll be like, Jay, what's going on with our big guy here? What's happening? But he always, you know, he's always kind of a calming influence for me back in the day when I was running player development. And I feel like he's got that vibe with you too, because, you know, a lot of times I'll be like, come on, what's going on with Riley, man? He's losing it. And Jay's like, listen, you know, he's coming along, he's working hard. You know, it's a process. And, you know, lo and behold, it looks to me like he was 100% right. Cause he told me recently that you're even out there hitting serves after you're done with your full intense day of training, 8 o'clock, 8:30 at night. The bot needs to get the practice in, and he's out on his own hitting serves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you said, Jay's one of the best in the business. He's an unbelievable player. You know, he's top 10 in the world, and he's an even better coach. He really is. And I think his vision and his philosophy and his mindset translates so much in the life as well, and even other sports. Look at his son. Look at Daniel. Obviously, Daniel has his own coach and caddy and his own setup, but his mindset is what makes Daniel Berger one of the best golfers in the world. And obviously, he got that from Jay. And, you know, you just look at Jay's, I'm a huge fan of him. You look at his entire family. All of his sons are great kids. His daughter's a doctor. There's something to, he's done a lot of things right, you know, and I think he's got a good outlook on life and a good mindset to be successful, because I don't know, you just look at everyone near him, everyone around him, and his family especially, they're all really thriving in what they do, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about you and how you've kind of, because I've seen you on the court at times when you're like, you're just not into it. You're like, why am I out here? I should have been a basketball player. You know, the attitude, like, be quite frank, wasn't great. And now I see a guy who's, I was watching you. I think it was when you were playing in Delray, you got to the final there. You've got a great start to this season. And, you know, your focus is just totally different. I mean, your movement's improved a lot, but I'm more, and I know you've been working hard on that, but I'm talking about the mindset of how you've been able to be, you know, because you kind of had that, like, what the F am I doing out here? Like, why am I doing this? And so for me watching as a commentator, I was like, man, God, this guy's got to work on the attitude. And now I see, you know, sort of this maturity out there. So what's that been like for you, that process?
Yeah, I think I've spent a lot of time working on my mindset, especially Jim Ware. Having Jim Ware in my corner is like the greatest thing ever. It's such a blessing. And
by the way, just speaking of Jim Ware, I did a podcast with him very recently, and he's just phenomenal. So I'm glad to hear that. I didn't even know you'd connected with him. That's awesome.
Yeah, I've been working with him since I was about 19 years. I mean, I've known him. He's helped me out from even a younger age, but we've been working on a regular, very regular basis since age 19 now. And I look at him, I mean, it's just a really good friend. And as you know, anyone that spends time with him realizes how sharp he is and how brilliant he is. And him and Jay's philosophies and mindsets line up so, so well with each other. And, you know, I think part of it was, with my mindset, was going through it, just experiencing certain things. It took me a little longer than others. And I think now I'm much calmer because actually my tennis has just gotten better. The times when I'm lost and annoyed is when I have no clarity or identity for what I'm trying to do when I'm on the court. And that's what would frustrate me. And now that doesn't happen as much. Even when I lose, it's fine because I have more clarity out there. And so it's just more fun. And I think a lot of that was just understanding my game, playing more matches, understanding what I do to guys, what my game, what kind of pressure that builds on guys, and vice versa, and just growing overall as a person. And I think that's what's really gotten my mindset on the court to be better. And I'm having more fun out there because I have a better understanding for why I'm out there and what I'm doing out there.
Do you think physically you're in the best shape you've been in?
For sure. And I mean, even that ties into it as well. I'm moving so much better. I'm fitter. I'm able to last out there, no problem. I'm getting the balls. I'm able to play more points. There's more action in my matches, so that just makes it more fun. And that's why, you know, even when I lose now, I don't really get angry or question why I'm out there or what I'm doing, because it's just more fun.
You know, I remember watching you. Obviously, you were in Boca at the USTA Training Center, which was where we sort of started this program, and I would go down there periodically, and I remember just seeing you over the years, you know, this tall, the big, skinny kid, and it was a longer process for you because of your physique, because of your body type, you know, and being able to handle the wear and tear. So how has the process been for you sort of learning how best to take care of your body so that you can perform at that level consistently?
Yeah, I've invested a lot of time and money into it. I mean, it's what it is. I have a physio and have someone working on me every day. The key is, well, for me, not, you know, it doesn't, everyone's body is different. Everyone has to understand their own body, and you have to go through this long trial and error process and test each thing out before you move on to the next and figure out what works for you. And everyone's so different in that way. But I think I'm really kind of on the what is going to be the key for the rest of my career. But it's been spending time in the gym, and that's not stretching and doing corrective exercises and bands. I'm still doing, but it's just moving weight. I'm lifting a lot of weight. I'm getting a lot stronger. I started working with Eric Cressy about a year ago, maybe a year and a half now, and I've gotten much, much stronger. And in return, I've gotten quicker on the court. My body's held up a lot better. I feel better. I think it's a healthy way to go about life, is lifting weight, moving weight, pushing your body in a safe way. And I've noticed so many things that's just come along with it. I've been sleeping better. Because I've invested all this time into my body, you know, I've been wanting to eat cleaner and do things the right way and get more sleep and more recovery time throughout the day. And before that, when you don't make that investment, you're not spending the time and the money on it, and it's easy to let the other categories slip away from you. And because I've just dedicated so much time into it, I'm like, man, I don't want to, you know, just throw away what I just did in the gym and you know, eat junk food and have this candy bar and you know, go meet up with my friends tonight and not get as much sleep as I should. You know, when you start doing things with more purpose, everything just kind of falls into place, and that's sort of what's happened with me.
Yeah, and you talk about making the investment. It's not only making the investment of time, but also the investment of the money, right? Because us tennis players, we got to do it ourselves, essentially. And you've been outspoken about some of the ATP issues with prize money. Obviously, the pandemic playing a part in that. But when you look at now, as we appear to be, at least hopefully, sort of coming out of this and the pandemic, what's your overall feeling about the state of the ATP? Just financially, because I want to ask you about a couple other important issues as well, because I love the fact that you're not afraid to be to talk about it and be outspoken about it. So tell me what you think, first of all, about the prize money situation with the tour.
Yeah, the prize money situation with the tour is a really tough topic, and I get it. I mean, I get why like a jackass sometimes talking about it. No one wants to hear, you know, a guy making much more money than the average, you know, that salary complaining about money. I totally understand that. And it's tough on the players because it's a tough position. You don't want to be the guy that's complaining about money while you're making a lot of money. But, you know, I have no problem taking that one on the chin. I really don't. Because I know the extent that the top 50, top 100 guys, even beyond that, I know the extent of work they put in. It's a 24-hour job. I leave my house at 7 a.m. and I don't get back sometimes till 8 p.m. And then even then, I'm working with my physio after that, and I'm in bed at 10 p.m. That's really a full day. And the extent we push our bodies in the short time period we have to make our money, these 10, 12 years are important. And I'm quite concerned about it. I don't want to be. I'm not trying to be this advocate or this politician, let's say, in tennis. I don't want to be that at all. But it's troubling. I'm concerned that the sport is going in the wrong direction. I think there's so much, I've mentioned the conflict of interest, the lack of transparency, this 30-year deal that's about to be pushed through, which is very concerning in itself. Just one, the fact that we don't know exactly what it is, and two, the fact that it's 30 years. You don't see too many deals nowadays that long. You can't predict how much the world's going to change from a social standpoint, even after 5 years, so let alone 30. I have a lot of concerns, and I don't really know where it's going. I don't know where the tour's going to end up, and that's what's troubling for me.
Would you like to see the players just have their own union, just period?
Totally. We're the only sport that doesn't. I don't get why the PTPA gets criticized, and there's other players that go against it, which I don't understand, quite frankly. It doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't we want our own leadership? We're the only sport that doesn't have it. I mean, you look at every single major sports organization, they all have their own players. They all have their own representation, and it makes sense.
Yeah, it's a little tricky that, especially because Novak Djokovic is the guy who's been the leader, and I admire what he's done with that. Particularly, as he's been chasing these majors for the last couple of years, and he's sort of been in the thick of it. And now, of course, with the whole vaccination issue, in some ways it's a little bit of the problem is that he's sort of the focal point of it, and he's just taken so much heat, some of it deserved, for his stances on various things. The vaccination is a whole nother issue. So do you think that's sort of hurting the PTPA's push in this sense that, Novak is a guy, despite the fact that I believe that he's got the right intentions, but publicly, it's a dicey situation at best.
It's totally dicey. And he does have the right intentions. There's no doubt about it. He's, let's say, more than okay from a financial standpoint. His grandkids, his great grandkids are going to be just fine when it comes to finances. And I think that's what shows a lot about his character, the fact that he's still willing to fight for the other players. I mean, it's completely out of his best interest to do this. And it has, as we've seen, it's completely out of his best interest to do this. It'd be easy for him to, have a complete opposite perspective of it and protect his own brand and protect his name, like we've seen some of the other guys do. And I think it just shows he really is a man of principle, and that you have to admire. I always respect someone that's not a hypocrite. And one thing you can never call Novak is a hypocrite. He says what he believes in, and he doesn't, he's not a two-faced guy. I really enjoyed spending time with him when I have, and chat with him in the locker room that I have, and I have nothing but utmost respect for him for a lot of reasons.
Were you surprised he was in the draw in Indian Wells?
Yeah, but you automatically get entered. It's an automatic, right. It's an automatic entry. That's how it works. These are mandatory events. These Masters are mandatory. And that's another thing we can even talk about with Masters being, Masters events have a total monopoly on the ATP. They are mandatory. You get penalized as a player, as a top player, for not playing in them. And going to be interesting to see what they do with Shanghai. I mean, you're going to penalize guys for not wanting to go to China?
I've been coming down on the ATP for a while now for still having Shanghai and other events on the calendar. That's a whole nother topic. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I mean, I don't even know where to start with that one. It's funny, you know, you have some of the top players at the game, some of the biggest names in the game tweeting in the pandemic that they want to merge with the WTA, and they're all for this pro merge out of nowhere. And then the next day we're playing in China. You know, that says a lot right there. You know, I mean, that says a lot about the ATP, I think, in its current state right there. And I get it. It's in everyone's best interest to look out for themselves and do what's best for them. And tennis players seem to do that more than anyone else because it is an individual sport. It's a lonely sport. And you kind of have to have that chip on your shoulder. You kind of have to be selfish to be great in this business. You really do. It's transferred into other parts, which I don't like.
You know? Yeah, transferred into like the organizational part. And, you know, the WTA putting themselves out there and saying, you know, we're not going to China. And then lo and behold, a couple months later, because they took a stand, a moral stand, they signed this huge new deal, you know, for their tour, which their tour has way more at stake in China than the men's tour does. And meanwhile, I mean, and then we can't get them to make a decision on Zverev for his actions in Acapulco, which I thought was a complete joke. What they, you know, totally. Do you agree with that too? That, I mean, they didn't even suspend him.
Yeah, but that leads me to the question: what would someone have to do to get suspended? Is the better question? It's, you know, how much can you push the envelope on that? It's interesting. I don't know what more you can do. I mean, would you have to like physically, you know, would you have to had to have
physically attack or actually hit the umpire with his racket, which he almost did?
Yeah, or even Glasspool at the handshake, it was close. The thing that's crazy, I mean, it's comical about that, is it's a doubles match. I mean, I can't imagine not even a slam doubles match. I couldn't imagine myself ever exploding like that in really any match where I'm hitting my racket against a chair. I just couldn't imagine that, but especially in a doubles match, and especially the top singles player, I mean, it must have been something going on, I think, off the court. Not finding an excuse for him by any means. I'm just saying I'm just trying to understand. I'm trying to wrap my head around it, but it doesn't make sense as to why that outburst would come in a doubles match. A match that means absolutely nothing to anyone, especially to Zverev. It doesn't make sense. I can't wrap my head around
there's some serious anger issues going on there. That's what it appears, you know, watching from the outside.
Totally. Yeah, it appears there's something deeper going on there, something that is goes beyond a line call in a tennis match, that's for sure. And, you know, it's not a personal dig. It's Zverev. I would have said if it was anyone, if it was my best friend, Tommy Paul that acted that way, right. I would say the same thing. If it was Tommy or Fritz or Francis that did that, I would say the same thing. You got that's a suspension. That's time out from the sport. That's how you handle that situation.
So you say to one of your kids, you know, it's time, you need a timeout. You need to take a little break here. So before I let you go, because you've already given me a ton of time and I appreciate it as you're getting ready for a big tournament out there. I just got to ask you a couple of more, you know, lighter questions, which are about, you know, now that you've been out there a few years and, you know, we in the media, we like to say who's the greatest of all time. And I remember talking to Marty Fish about this, you know, because he played against the big three in their prime. They're still in their prime, a couple of them, obviously. But he used to, he said to me, he thought Djokovic was the hardest guy for him ever to play. So you've had the chance to play now, you know, for a few years on tour and just kind of give, you know, because I know the fans would love to hear from you, a top guy, about sort of your, you know, break down each of the guys and you know, who's the toughest one you've ever played? For what reason?
I've only played Rafa of the three, but, you know, I played him in Rome, which is as tough of a task as you can possibly find. From the outside, watching tennis and everything, you know, I think Roger's done the most for tennis in terms of his name, his aura, everything. I mean, he just, sport looks so beautiful when he does it. It's, got this, it's just different when he plays. Everyone that comes out to watch, that comes to watch him, you know, it's, you know, he's one of the most recognizable figures in the world, and everything about him is so perfect, and he's funny, he's so nice, he's so lovable, he's great off the court with everyone, behind the camera as well, and he's just elegant, and everything about him is perfect, and it's crazy, and I think he's done the most for tennis, and you know, Rafa is like the opposite there, the perfect rivalry. Rafa at its high on clay is the highest level that's ever been played. For sure. On clay, when he's at his best, there's never been a level of tennis that's been near that level, not even close. But if you look at every surface, hard, clay, grass, everything, every tournament, week in, week out, the toughest task in tennis on any court at any time, at any tournament, is to beat Novak Djokovic. So that's my take on it. He's the toughest guy to beat overall on every service, in every event. You know, you play him on a fast court, you're in trouble. You play him on a grass court, you're in trouble. You play him on a slow clay court, it's tough. You know what I mean?
Right.
Any sort of condition, he's probably not going to lose.
He's the most adaptable, basically. I mean, the other guys 100%, are, yeah,
100%.
As far as being able to play and can, you know, play at his closest to his highest level in basically any condition. Whereas if you play, you know, if you play Rafa on a slick grass court, I mean, he's not going to be anywhere near what he is obviously on clay, but even on a medium to slow hard court.
Yeah, totally. Novak is the toughest task in tennis is to beat him for sure. And that just goes on any surface in at any time of the year. It's really amazing, kind of. It's freaky to see what he's done. And to do it week in, week out, he's really set the bar high, and he's kind of the house. He changed the game, there's no doubt about it, as did Rafa, as did Roger.
Let's hope he comes back. I mean, let's hope he can come back and start, you know, because, I mean, it's a huge blow for tennis. I mean, for putting the politics aside and whether you agree with his stance on vaccination or not, I mean, I don't, but that doesn't really matter. I'm a fan of tennis, and, you know, you want to see, you know, it's a bummer. It's a total bummer to me that he's not able to play right now. And again, a lot of it's his decision, but as you said, you know, he's sticking to his principles. Do you think, I guess it sounds like he's going to be able to play in Europe. It sounds like the restrictions are being lifted there. So what do you, and the last thing I want to ask you before I let you go, what do you hear? What are you seeing at the tournament? I know you've been practicing, you haven't played any matches yet, but you know, with the Russian players who we all know well, and obviously with the war going on, it's, you know, they're in a tough situation, but what's sort of the vibe around tour about what's happening in the world and then what these guys and women are doing out on the tour?
Yeah. From the men's side, it's, if you are in this business, and you know, the Russian guys are some of the best guys on tour, I think. I mean, Medvedev is so nice. Rublev is the kindest guy, the nicest guy there is. Same with Khachanov and those guys. And Krasov, even. They're really just great quality guys. And, you know, I even saw in the statement, the ATP, the language they use is like, for the time being, Russian players, something like that. You know, I don't know the exact language, but it was like, at the current moment, Russian players will still be allowed to play. It's like, I didn't even like that language. Of course they should be allowed to play. I mean,
right.
These are really good quality guys. You cannot, I mean, the fact that that was even I mean, they would consider they shouldn't be. I mean, you can't punish them and discriminate against them for something that Medvedev lives in Monte Carlo. Andre lives in, I think, either Dubai
in Spain.
Or Monte Carlo.
Yeah, they're in Spain. Yeah.
In Spain. And Karen lives in Dubai. I mean, you cannot even think about punishing them or looking down or looking at them one bit different because of what's going on in the world. Those guys are top quality guys. And, it would be a huge disappointment if there was any sort of restriction put in place for any Russian player. I think that's discrimination at its finest, actually. And I would be more than upset if those guys weren't allowed to play, because and same for the women. I mean, they're a huge part of our sport, and you can't penalize them or even change your perspective on them because of this. They have nothing to do with it. Like I said, speaking on Andre, on their side, they're the nicest guys, some of the nicest guys on tour. I would be just, you know, shocked, and I'd be ashamed if they were punished for this.
Right. Well, let's hope they get a good reception when they take the court, as they will in the next couple of days. I know you will, Riley. Opelka joining me here on Holding Court. And let me tell you something. You should be proud of the fact that you're the number one American. I know you want more, and that's a great quality to have, because all great players, you know, aren't satisfied. And I commend you for speaking out on these issues and doing what you believe is right. And you're a role model. You know, and I'm going to say this. I'm going to say this because you showed up at our tennis academy a month or so ago. You didn't even tell me, which I'm still a little pissed off about, but I got over it. But when I heard, they said, "Oh yeah, Riley was here doing something," and you took pictures with all the kids. Nobody knew you were coming, and that's what it's all about, man. I mean, and you get it, and right. So keep doing your thing, keep speaking out. And keep doing what bots do, but you're doing a lot more than just what bots do, and that's fun to watch.
Thanks, T-Mac. Yeah, I had a good time at your academy. I couldn't believe how big your academy was and how big it's going to be, and especially in New York. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Only the McEnroe family can pull something off like that. But it was really cool to see how many kids were there. I mean, you don't see that too often. Young kids. That means there's going to be a couple of those guys that are going to be playing at Indian Wells in the near future, which is really, really exciting.
Yeah. Well, we hope so. We hope so. But you know, you keep doing your part, because it's important what you do, and sending that example and being an example, but what you do on the court, but off the court as well. So I appreciate you joining me. Good luck. I'm planning on seeing you out there, because I'm getting out there for the last 4 days of the tournament. I'm planning to see Mr. Opelka deep in the tournament at the BNP Paribas Open.
Awesome. Thanks, T-Mac.
All right. Riley Opelka, everyone, on Holding Court.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.